Hi, and welcome to the Indie Music Podcast, the podcast for independent musicians and other music professionals. We're your hosts, myself, Matt Denton, also known as Mojo, of Ragged Birds Music. I'm a recording artist and mix engineer. And Douglas Reynolds of Resonance Studio, a mastering and recording engineer. When you said 5 minutes, I thought you meant 5 minutes from 5:30.
Well, it's 7:33.
You're better at math than that. I know you are. No, that's cool. I only just finished work a little bit ago. I got at a work meeting go along, and then I jammed out into the kitchen and made some enchiladas real quick and then jammed back in here. Anyway, how are you, Doug?
I'm doing well.
Yeah.
I'm kind of tired. I was had very little sleep yesterday.
Did you dream about Warren Hewitt like I did?
I'm really curious now.
No, posted it on Twitter. No, I had a weird dream about Warren Hewitt that I was in some house somewhere and he was showing me like this exotic collection of, you know, percussion instruments he had just gotten like on eBay and stuff, like all these weird like hand drums and things. And then I was like, oh, I gotta go catch a train. I don't know. It was really strange, but kind of cool.
I don't even know what to say.
Yeah, don't read into that. It was just fun. It was a fun dream.
Was it marvelous?
No, it was. It wasn't marvelous. It was, you know, it was. Warren is marvelous, though. We love Warren.
We do.
We should love try him. To have him on as a guest sometime. I don't know if he has time for that
God,
stuff.
That's a good
wouldn't
idea.
Wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that be it fun would. To have him on here?
Oh, the wheels are turning.
So today, as promised, unless you have more to, you sound like you just want to jump right into the episode.
No, I was really wanted to come up with a creative segue, but I didn't have like an opportunity yet.
Oh, how about on it. So you said you had a rough week. Are you feeling low?
Yeah, feeling pretty low.
Feeling kind of low, like how low? Like 120 hertz, maybe
yeah,
80
right
hertz
in
low?
That neighborhood. Yeah.
In that neighborhood? Yeah,
I'm feeling a little muddy, you know?
Like bass level low? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I'm trying to do a
speaking,
Doug, a Doug
speaking
segue.
Of which.
Speaking of which, we promised we'd talk about bass this week.
We
so
did.
We're moving up then, from drums, the foundation, up the scale, up the, not the real scale, but the frequency range, climbing the ladder. So bass is next.
Yeah. And my impression here, after speaking with you over the past couple of weeks and getting to this point of recording about bass, is that you have been super excited about this episode.
I said that, yes. I did say that, yeah. No, I enjoy mixing the bass.
Yeah.
I love the sound of bass. I love playing bass. Lately, since we've been home, the thing that I gravitate more towards when I want to practice and just kind of noodle around is bass more than guitar, interestingly. But yeah.
What do you think it is, you know, about the bass instrument and where and recording and the whole production process so that, you know, you really dig? What is it about this in particular?
Well, bass to me is everybody talks about the vocals are king. Everybody talks about the drums are the foundation. Everybody talks about the guitars. You want to be a guitar hero. You want to get the guitars wide and boom, the guitars are the riffs, they're the part that you kind of hum and you air guitar along. But of all the elements, the one that, and every bassist out there knows this, that they are the unsung hero of every song. If you have a memorable song with a memorable groove, it's probably because of the bass line. It's probably not because of the killer drums and guitar. The bass is the glue between the rhythm of the drums and the melody and tonality of the central vocal, usually the vocal melody, although in some genres like, you know, hard rock and metal, it kind of goes very much along with the guitar. So it glues the guitars and the drums together, but it's very much a rhythmic and melodic element. And I think it's very often the spirit of the song.
I can see that because you're really tying together. When I think about it, you're tying together, and it's basically what you said, the drum, the rhythm section, mm-hmm. and, you know, and then the instruments.
Yeah.
And you know, and that brings that together. So I definitely get your glue analogy on that.
Well, they frequently call it the battery, you know, the drums and bass, they call them the battery sometimes. And in baseball, the battery is the pitcher and catcher. And yeah. Like, you can't have a team without a pitcher and catcher. And I don't think you can have much of a song without a bass and drums. So I think, yeah, I just love the power of it. I love the low wind, the yeah. growl, the power, the thump, the boom, the all that stuff. I love that stuff.
So I got a personal question for you.
Okay.
When's the last time you changed the strings on your bass?
You know what? I can tell you because I have a sticker. I take blue tape and put it on the back of my headstock with a date of when I last changed my bass. And I'm not sure I want to answer that on tape. But it's been a while. When I looked at that, I was like, that can't be right. But yeah, it's been more than a couple of years.
Now, I think that may be typical.
I think it's not uncommon. It's like there's with guitars, people like to have a fresh set of strings almost with every show, every recording session. With bass, you either like that fresh sound, that pop, that twang, that buzz yeah. of a fresh new set, or you like the broken in sound. And I do like the fresh twang sound, but on other people's basses. On mine, I like that worn in low end, especially because I play with a pick. I don't play with fingers. And with fingers, you usually get the round transient, right? The doo 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 doo. But when you play with a pick, you get a sharper transient. But I think with broken in strings, you get somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think they are definitely mellower. There's a tonal difference. And I think a lot of players maybe like that more rounded tone that you get from an older string.
Yeah. You know, hang on one second. It's right across the room. I'm just going to grab them right now.
All right. Need some little music to play here during this. I've never podcasted by myself before. I don't know what to say.
The blue tape says 516.
516.
So May of 2016 was the last
May,
time.
May 16th of 2020.
Yeah, no. May of 2016. So they're 4-year-old strings.
They just broke in.
They just broke in, exactly. Now, I have been known, and again, all bassists know this, bass strings are really expensive.
They are, yeah.
They're like, last time I was like, they cost how much?
You know,
and I think that's one of the reasons you change them so infrequently, because you're like, dude, I gotta save up multiple pairs of guitar strings to afford one pair of bass strings.
But if you wipe them down with isopropyl after you play every time, true. You can probably get 10 or 12 years out of them.
Yeah, I don't do the boiling thing, because then you have to take them off. And when you take them off, you have to
Wipe them down with a cloth with isopropyl on.
Yeah, as long as you make sure not to get that on your fretboard.
Yeah.
But you can buy individual strings, because I do a lot of one string note playing, a lot of one string playing. And if I'm going to replace, I would probably just replace the low string, which I have tuned down to D, instead of replacing all four strings.
Yeah.
Which I've done. So that 516 may not even be entirely accurate.
So what's your typical setup for tracking bass?
Now, I have a couple of nice bass amps that I'll dig, and I have some nice pedals that I dig, but when I track DI. And when I mix, I mostly mix with DI as well, because, I don't know, that's kind of almost a common industry thing, I feel like, to use the DI, and you do this too, you said. You just seem to get more full range of frequencies with a direct input of the bass, and then you blend it with the amp, or I like to use some plugins like I know like people like the Sans amp, which comes with Pro Tools. I don't have that, but I have an equivalent, and I like to use that Waves R bass, which is not just a compressor, but it's also like a harmonic generator, and boy, it can add some nice growl and thump and deepness to DI.
Yeah, I like the DI channel because I can do things with it in post more so. You can still mess with, your mic preamp in, but I like to run it through Two Notes Audio's.
Oh yeah, you mentioned Two Notes. I keep forgetting to look at that.
And I've got a few bass cabinets. I usually gravitate towards the the 4x10 Guild Heart Key cabinet simulator. And because I just like the tone of that.
Oh, the Heart Key, yeah. I like Galen Kruger is my go-to. And I like, yeah, they have a plugin, yeah, that's very good.
I have that one too. So, and I actually have the GK amp simulator for that too. So I've used that before.
Yeah. Do you ever do, now speaking of Warren Hewitt, who I mentioned a minute ago, he has a trick that he likes to use, and he's shown it on his live channel a bunch of times, where he likes to take the DI and he takes the amplified recorded version of the amp, and then uses them together, but in different frequency ranges. Like he'll use the DI low and then the amp high. So the amp part cuts through the mix, and then the DI part provides the bottom end. I like to blend them both together, but he likes to do like a low pass on the DI, yeah, and just use like up to like maybe 250 or something, and then cross over with a high pass on the amp and get all the part that cuts through and adds the growl and the color.
Yeah.
It's an interesting trick. I like it.
It is.
But I send mine to a bus. Like we talked about buses before, I have a bass bus. So I send my DI and my amp to a bass bus. And then I use that bus to be the amp. And I do that with other instruments too, but I like to do it with bass. And then I use like the, not to get into plugins again, but I really dig the Kramer, the Kramer tapes, tubes, and compressors, the Pi compressor for bass, and the HLS console, which I use as an EQ also for bass. Although the Sheps is good too.
Do you have a go-to microphone?
I don't generally record direct to the amp, so no.
Okay.
What about you?
Yeah, I have. It's a Lewitt 640 Rex. What is that? DTP 640 Rex, I think.
Is that like the same that you would use maybe on a kick? Because I know that a lot of people use, say, a 57, yeah, on a guitar cab, but because the bass has lower frequencies, you'd use a different kind of microphone.
Yeah. And yeah, it's a designed for capturing lower frequencies. You could use it on a tuba. It'd be perfect.
A tuba.
You could.
That would be cool. I've never mic'd a tuba. Saxophone and trumpet, yes. Tuba, no.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think back to middle school band and high school band, and what were they using for tuba? I think they were just always had a bunch of 57s on stage, yeah, and just shove it in the bell of whatever brass instrument was playing.
So you're capturing the DI and tracking that way with so mostly doing post production work as far as amps and cabinet simulators go. How about DI out of amp heads and stuff like that? So I mean, most bass amps actually have DIs built into them, at least modern ones.
Right.
Do you use what?
That's a really good question. So I always think of, because I any mix bunch, I just got one yesterday, a bunch of stems usually comes with a bass DI and a bass amp. And the amp is always, I assume, a microphone in front of a cabinet. But I never think to wonder where the DI come from. I always assume that somebody split their signal with a DI box and sent it straight to console or DAW. But I never thought maybe somebody's having it come right out of the back of an amp head. I guess I could ask. That'd be interesting to find out.
Because alternatively, what you could, normally what I'm seeing is having two bass tracks normally.
Right.
You have more certainly, but, and one being mic'd and running into like a DI box that basically then has a line out to the line level input, on an interface or the mixer board, and then the other one runs out to a balanced preamp input XLR,
right?
To get two signals out of the same source. That, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, no, totally. And I'm sorry, I was drifting off because I was having like three ideas for future podcast episodes. One about gain staging, one about DI boxes, and something else. Do you have a go-to DI box? Do you like passive or active? I mean, we could talk about this in a future episode, but why not now?
Honestly, I'm able to DI directly into my interface.
Yeah.
So I usually just take whatever line level I have and just take it straight in there. So I don't use a separate box for that.
Yeah, I do the same too. But I know it's not uncommon in a studio to have a DI box that splits the signal, send one to the amp, send one to the console, record direct console, and then record the amp. And I think originally the old DI thing was so that you could reamp it later, meaning that you could take that signal, run it through an amplifier and get a different signal. And of course now you would use plugins, but, it turns out bass in particular, just there's something about the DI signal that's just more pure, more clean, and you can just, it's more versatile, really.
Yeah. And see, that 640 Rex actually has two capsules in it.
Oh.
And it outputs into a special cable. It's a splitter. And so I actually get two channels recorded off the one microphone.
Huh.
And it's got, then the capsules have different qualities. It's got like a... it's got a dynamic and why is that word escaping me right now?
Condenser?
Condenser. Thank you. It's got both dynamic and condenser mics.
Oh, that's really cool. I guess I don't know that microphone very well. No, I have the Lewitt LCT 240 Pro, as I think I mentioned before, and that's what I'm recording on right now. It's funny that we're both Lewitt fans, and I think I could speculate that we both learned about Lewitt through Produce Like a Pro.
Yeah.
Although I'd have to say so. Before that, through Mixer Man, he mentioned it in one of his books.
I think they're a good company. They interact in social media, and I like them. They're outgoing and friendly people.
Yeah, it feels like a young company. They're outgoing, friendly, and they do contests and they give away stuff. They are active on social media, and they just seem to have a good attitude. And along with good products that are well made and affordable. And now here we sound like a commercial for Lewitt microphones. Yeah. My fault, but
we love them.
I stand behind it. I'm recording in one right now. What am I going to say? I don't buy a lot of hardware, and this is one of the things I purchased, and I'm very happy with it.
Yeah. Now, obviously, there's other mics. So, I mean, we could certainly like the AKG D112 is a classic.
I like AKG, and I like AT.
The Shure 52, I think. I don't have one, so.
No, I still need a 7B. That's still on my list.
I'm actually looking for it right now. Shure Beta 52, I think.
Yeah, isn't the Beta 52 similar to it's like a lower cost version of the 57 or the 58? Am I wrong?
Let me double check something because I don't have this specific mic. Yeah, I think it's the Beta 52A.
I mean, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
You definitely have a bigger mic locker than I do. Mine is more...
It's not huge.
Mine is a small but mighty collection. I got a 57, a 58. I got a Behringer B2 that I recorded multiple albums on. I'm very happy with it. I have the Lewitt LCT 240 Pro, which I'm liking. It's very clean and crisp, and it's really good for podcasting. I have a vintage mic whose name escapes me right now, and I also have a kick mic that I thought would be cool to try to record vocals on. It's a CAD, but I forget the number. That's kind of it. My latest acquisition was the my most expensive microphone was the Slate modeling microphone, and what is it, the M1?
I believe that's what you told me. It's very, I don't know, it's cool. Yours.
Very cool. I know, right? I don't remember these names. I just know what it looks like. I'm a visual guy. I remember these acronyms and stuff. The only reason I know the name of the Lewitt is because the letters are like 6 inches from my face. It's right there. I'm reading it as I'm saying it. Too funny.
Yeah, I'm mainly like 57s, the Lewitt. I've got like Rode NT1.
Yeah, I'm kind of jealous about your MT1, but okay.
It's nice. I really like it.
And yet you stopped using it for your podcast because you got that shotgun mic now.
Yeah, I've got the Cinco. And I think next time I get an opportunity to record someone singing, I'd really like to try this microphone on a vocalist. I think it would be good. And even so much as maybe move it back because of the directional properties of this mic and use it in combination with the Rode blend. Those together, I think, might be interesting. And then I have I got a match small diaphragm pair of I think those are Lauten.
Okay, so which one of those do you use on a bass cab?
Oh, I would use the that Lewitt mic on a bass cab.
Yeah. You ever blend it with like a 58 or 57, I mean?
No, I haven't actually. I did it live. You know, we just throw 57s on everything live.
Exactly. Yeah, except the 58 vocals to 57 live. You know? I mean, you just, yeah. It's just what you do. So tell me a little bit about how do you treat bass? So I kind of went over how I treat them. I usually blend the DI and the amp cab and I bust them together and I throw some Kramer tape saturation shit on there and go to town. I like the growl. I like the punch, but I also want to make sure that it cuts through the mix at the same time. So what's your approach?
I like to add saturation. Normally, at least on one of the channels that get blended in, usually the DI and oftentimes I'm using the amp sim in the Two Notes plugin, and I just crank the gain on it. Like I absolutely just make it filthy, and then I bring that channel down, and I blend that up just so that it gives like a subtle under growl to it, mm-hmm. and bring it together to taste, you know, generally. But I also kind of emphasize the transients on that channel too, and bring that in, and because I'm generally have a kind of cutting those or compressing those transients on like the mic channel,
yeah.
And so I bring that together. That's kind of my flavor.
You're pretty big on transient shaping, aren't you?
Yeah, I think it's really important.
Yeah, when you're saying about the boosting, I was thinking of that that Tom Lord Alge Fix My Mix seminar we were watching earlier. He was like talking about, he goes by ear. He mentioned an anecdote where he was like, because he loves to boost shit. And he was mentioning an anecdote. He used to have to put tissue paper over the meters when the producer would come in because he didn't want them to see how much he was boosting stuff because they would be like, you can't turn it up that much. And he was like showing off his EQ. He's got stuff boosted like 12 dB. And he's like, if you need more, you can always add a second plug.
Yeah.
He's like,
it goes like, up to 15, but if you need like, more, just throw another one
exactly.
on there.
He's like, hey man, don't be afraid to give it the juice.
Yeah.
I love that. He's just like, he's so funny.
Yeah.
But he's like, yeah, it's just, I want it to sound like this. And he's like, crank.
Yeah. You got to go with your gut. Like you said,
you got to go with your gut. You got to
make the decision.
Serve the song, make it sound good. And yeah. It's too much. I don't usually go that far, but
yeah.
Well, I mean, the guy knows what he's doing.
Right. I think beyond that, though, and it, you know, when I'm doing it, the bass tracks are generally among the most simple. EQing is really important to me on that, you know, and getting it to play well with the kick drum and keeping it out of the way of the guitars and low vocals. And so that's really carving out space and clearing out space through other techniques like sidechain compression.
Right.
I never have a reason not to sidechain to the kick drum because I just like it.
Right.
I don't know if that's typical.
I don't know.
I want to hear the kick drum.
Me too. So I want to hear the snare, yep. and the vocal above everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, that bass has got to be there.
Yeah. And so in order to keep the bass there, but to allow the kick come through because they're in competing ranges, I'll sidechain and I'll duck the bass a little bit to mm-hmm. On the kick drum, and that's just subtle, and it's something that's not hard to do that makes a big impact and allows that the kick drum to have some room in the mix.
Yeah,
beyond that, it's EQing.
Yeah,
mud areas, pulling some down and sometimes pretty aggressively, you know, in the 400 area.
Yeah, it can get muddy there and cause. Yeah. And that's when you like to do the boost and sweep. You boost in a short range, you sweep around until you find the whoop, 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 and then you just cut that out.
Yep.
But I kind of feel like of all of the things, maybe the bass takes the least amount of work and effort because you just like, you know where it sounds good, you know what to move it out of the way of. You know what its function is, what its purpose is. You know what you want it to sound like in the song. And it kind of, I feel like after I got the drums, I put the bass in and then I kind of forget about it until I get to the end. And I'm like, okay, I got everything else working. And then I'll go back and go, okay, I can't hear the bass as well on, say, earbuds, or I can't hear the bass as well on this. So then I'll like do some frequency adjusting to make sure that you can hear it on all different kind of mediums, but Yeah, I feel like it's one of the simpler areas to mix as long as you don't overdo it. Now, what about, now I should throw this out there, what about synth bass? Do you treat that differently?
Oh, it depends.
Do you have much like an
800 or something like that?
Well, I mean, sometimes, I mean, let's say you have like a Nine Inch Nails type song where there's not an actual, maybe there's not an actual Fender bass playing with a DI. Maybe it's an actual it's MIDI from the get-go that's been distorted. Yeah. And
well, I would probably treat that differently initially because I probably wouldn't run that through the same plugin set like true. I do in a, you know, an
it's
electric
probably going to come through kind of pre-saturated and pre-compressed and like more or less the way it's supposed to sound when it's done.
Yeah, because I mean, whoever's set up the synth recording in the first place has already designed the sound of it.
Right.
But I would probably treat it the same regarding EQ and ducking and things like that to still work in the same space. You know, and one thing I didn't mention before is you know, it's not just working down in the 120 area or cutting mud in the 400 area, but you also need to be thinking about the bass transients and you know, in like 7 to 1200 mm-hmm. Hertz range to allow the bass to cut through the mix where you want it to as well.
Exactly.
And you know, and that's obviously you're going to have other things playing in that area, but you can certainly allow it to have some of its own space or dominance in that area where you want it to. And that might introduce some needs for automation, but when you get the sound that you want where you want it, then it's definitely worth it.
Exactly. I was going to say, yeah, that's why I like our bass because it does do the harmonic distortion. And that's why I like to add some distortion or...
I really like saturation,
cut it,
distortion on
like,
bass.
Do a send to... I always have a dirt channel and I would always do like a little send to dirt and just kind of get some grit in there. And then I do the... who is it? Andy Wallace. I think it's Andy Wallace. No, it might be... who's the one in Garbage? The other one in Mixed Nirvana. Anyway, he likes to send to he calls it a dirty chorus. So I do that. I have a distorted chorus auxiliary bus that I send a little bit of the bass to. So it has some fatness and width and cuts through in the mids. But
Billy Bush,
those fills in those in between moments, I will boost if there's like a little doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, you know, rather than expecting the whole bass to cut through the whole mix. When there's sections where the bass that does a little fill or something that needs to shine, I'll just pop that up in automation and make it shine a little bit. And you go, oh, there it is. Flea.
Yeah.
You know?
I think Billy Bush is the engineer for Garbage.
Oh, no.
The mix engineer.
Not the engineer, but the member.
Oh, the bass player? I don't know who that is.
Hang on. I'm looking him up. Butch Vig.
Oh.
I think that might have been a Butch Vig trick and not a Andy Wallace trick. Got to keep my producer straight.
What other type of considerations do you have in how you get bass to play? You know, it's like I mentioned with guitar, I'm generally going to be carving out that space. I'm going to keep the guitar away from the, you know, that low range too, you know, so the guitar is going to get carved some for its own space to keep it from, there's no reason for it to be taking up space in the bass guitar range because it's already covered, you know?
Yeah, I want to say that's where it gets tricky for me because, you know, I like, I'm going to say that it depends on program material because I like, you know, say I like a really like thumpy palm muted guitar like in hard rock and metal where it goes chung, 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 chung. And a lot of times in that genre, the bass also plays along with it. And sometimes you can't hear the bass except on certain speakers because it's mixed so low. And I do find something where, okay, where's the crossover point where I want the guitar to be that low chunk chunk? And where do I want the bass to fill that in where the guitar, guitar's cut off?
That's genre specific, like djent or something like that. Mm-hmm,
something like that.
I think that it's expected that the bass and the guitar are going to play in the same neighborhood, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, if you're going to lose bass notes because the guitar player is really covering it, I guess it's intended.
Yeah.
I would still be trying to find ways to allow that bass to come through.
I think so too, especially in moments where it's shy. And then, you know, and that's where it depends on the band and stuff. Is the bassist playing with old strings or new strings?
Yeah.
You know, because if they're playing with new strings, it really is going to kind of compete with the guitars. It's going to be that metallic that's up there. And then, you know, the guitar. Yeah, it's a lot of, then you're just going to kind of have to dig in and go, okay, what's important in this part of the song? And how do I carve out these frequencies to make one shine over the other? I still think panning is kind of a cheap way to separate things because you don't always listen to stuff on earphones. And I feel like it should separate a mono. It should separate if you're standing in the other room. You shouldn't lose an instrument because somebody panned the same frequency to different sides. That to me, that's I mean, that doesn't seem right.
I'm not really a proponent of I don't practice panning in low frequencies.
No,
so I like them up the middle.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to be the guy sitting on the right side in the car and all the basses on the left side.
Farting, you know? You're like, oh my God, what is going on? I've blown out speakers in cars before. They start buzzing. That's not a good feeling. But bass should be up the middle. You can think back to, say, you know, some, you know, older music when stereo was just starting out, or you can think of, say, when you have kind of like a lead bass situation with Iron Maiden or Black Sabbath, where sometimes a bass will be off to one side and it's you know, it's double or the, you know, the delay, the distorted delay is sent to the opposite side. You can do that sometimes for effect, but generally you know, kick, snare, and bass should more or less be up the middle, because bass is kind of omnidirectional, and so it doesn't make sense to have it eating up the frequency on one side instead of just be in the center.
Yeah, I think I'd have to, I need to go back and listen, but like Dream Theater's John Myung,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't remember, you know, in trying to recollect my listening to Dream Theater albums, that his bass is panned.
Huh.
It seems to me he's up the middle. If you've ever seen him live, every time I've seen him, he's stage right.
Yeah.
In that context, I still don't, even in front of house stuff, remember feeling the bass being panned one side heavier than the other. You know, I guess if you were sitting up front, and although I think they have really good control of their stage volume. So.
Yeah, I think so too. And I guess I'm always paying attention to John Petrucci, so I never really noticed that much. But, you know, Tool is a band that, you know, Justin Chancellor and Adam Jones, they'll kind of trade off lead riffing. So sometimes you won't even know whether it's the bass or the guitar that's doing the lead riff and whether it's up the middle or off to the side. And, you know, obviously your rules are made to be broken, but.
Yeah. Now, if you had like a bass solo and like a single line and melody,
mm-hmm.
That's different.
Sure.
And there, you might even apply some techniques like you would on guitar in, you know, in laying down a track and then re-recording the track again. And, you know, so it's two musician recorded tracks. It's not a duplicate,
right.
But it's the artist playing the same thing on two tracks and then running them on two tracks and then panning each of those tracks to get a stereo spread on it. I could see doing that in like a John Petrucci type of bass solo with Chick Corea or something like that, you know, where he's come out of the rhythm section and he's come to the front with, he's handling the melody and the solo at that time. And it may be for a few minutes of a bass solo. I would probably treat that differently there.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, because then it becomes a lead instrument.
Yeah.
And so it needs more focus. And part of the point of putting it up the middle and putting it down is that it's more, slightly more rhythmic and more gluing the rhythm to the,
yeah.
the melody.
And oftentimes it's higher register on the instrument as well. So it's
right.
It's not all holding down the foundation on the low end, you know?
Yeah. Victor Wooten or... guys like that, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a whole kind of like a genre of lead bass that you might treat differently. But yeah, for the most part, and again, I think a lot of us were speaking in generalizations, but for the most part, you know, up the middle, keep it out of the way of kick, keep it out of the way of the guitars, give it enough mids that it cuts through the mix when you need it to, keep it foundational.
Sounds like a good place to start and, you know, and record some awesome bass tracks.
Yeah, now I want to go to listen to some Dream Theater.
Oh, dude, I highly recommend it.
I haven't listened to Images and Words in forever. I got to go listen to that.
And Myung's one of my favorite bass players.
In Prague,
like ever. So,
yeah, have you heard that live EP they did with that one track, Bombay Vindaloo? So good.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I got to go listen to some Dream Theater while I make a dinner. Right. Oh, this is a fun one. I love talking about bass.
Yeah.
So what do we do next time? Guitars or keyboards?
We can do guitars.
Yeah, I think we should go to guitars.
So
that'll be fun too.
What kind of guitars? Acoustic guitars?
Oh, maybe we need to do two guitar ones. We can take that offline.
Yeah, actually, I would really like to talk about acoustic guitar tracking.
I would too, because I don't know that much about it, and I would like to learn some things.
Yeah.
So sounds good.
We'll talk about it then. I'll leave you with one thought on that, and that is that it's not really the sound hole in a guitar where the sound comes out of.
Ooh, I'm going to be up at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about that.
All right. Hey, thanks everybody for joining us.
Yep. Thanks everyone. We appreciate you all and hope you're having a great week.
Yep.
Cheers, Doug. Cheers. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Well, that's it for another episode of the Indie Music Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, leave us a comment or a review and share with your friends. Hit us up on our website at indiemusiccast.com. Find myself on Twitter at Mojo's Army. Find Douglas on Twitter at Rezo Studio. Thanks. Until next time, keep creating.